If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
Hey guys, and welcome to Personality Bingo with me, your host, Tom Moran. So this week on the podcast, we have the brilliant Mags McAuliffe. Mags is an actor, a writer. She trained at the Gaiety School of Acting, and she's best known for her incredible one-woman show, The Humours of Bandon. That was a Fish Amble Shona bag a couple of years ago, and obviously the Fringe Festival in Dublin has just finished up, and I mean, it was an amazing festival. So much great work comes out of that, and I mean, Mags has just got like incredible mileage out of this show, only because it's absolutely brilliant. The demand for it's still there. She's still touring it internationally, nationally. It's absolutely incredible the success that this show has had. As well as that, Mags has worked with brilliant companies like Rough Magic. She was recently touring away in Norway, as we talk about, and yeah, she's just an all-round brilliant performer and is currently writing on the new Fish Amble scheme for new plays in Ireland, which is pretty sweet. So I'm excited to see what she's going to do next, and I'm excited for you to hear this episode. So without further ado, please enjoy the brilliant Mags McAuliffe playing Personality Bingo with Tom Moran.
Mags McAuliffe, ready to play Personality Bingo?
Yeah.
All right, sweet. So I'll give a quick explanation of how it all works. I've got 60 minutes on the clock here. I've got 60 questions in front of me and also 60 balls in the bingo machine. I should also say that I've given you 5 numbers on that sheet of paper. Would you do me a favour and read out the 5?
I've got 16,
yeah.
2,
okay.
3,
yes.
41,
right.
And 39.
Okay, nice one. Do me another favour. Pick a 6th number, something between 1 and 60 that's not already there. You are covering it very diligently, but you can tell me.
I don't know.
No, it's nice. I appreciate it. It's been mysterious.
5.
5.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Lucky number.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How did that come to be?
I think it's because it was the number I was in the Ardgrad Award in the 2000 Irish Open Championships of Irish Dancing.
Ah.
And I was competitor number 5 and I won. So I even remember the way the scoring went that day and what judges gave me how many points and even the numbers of the other competitors. It's a weird thing that just stuck in my head over the years. And it was back in 2000, so 18 years ago.
Sweet.
And yeah, so then when I went to write The Humours of Bandon, there's a section in it where there's like a calculation of points and it's literally the exact same way it went.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. It was lucky in 2000. Will it be lucky today? We'll see. And I should say that if it is lucky and you get all 6 of those numbers out, that means the tables are turned and you can ask me any question in the whole wide world.
Wow. Well, I've been playing the lotto for a few weeks now, so I know what the odds are.
All right. Here you go. All right, let's give it a spin. Okay, here we go. First out the gate, we have number 27. Do you have it?
No, I don't.
No worries. Number 27. The question is, what is your relationship, if any, to the gym?
To the gym?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We get on very well.
Really?
Yeah. I joined Westwood, more choice, better results, in 2000 when I moved, or 2010 when I moved to Clontarf. And initially, I went with, you know, you get your initial trainer to talk you through the different machines and stuff. And I realized quite quickly that I didn't suit that sort of gym going experience because I needed someone to kind of give me to sit on top of me literally and say, no, you need to do this now and you need to do that now. So the classes have been brilliant. So I go, well, I'm rehearsing at the moment, but generally I go 9:30 in the morning. On a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Friday. They've got body attack on a Tuesday and a Friday.
Very aggressive.
And body pump on Monday and Wednesday. So body pump is like weight training.
Yeah.
But to music. And I appreciate that because it's kind of like choreography and weights together. And then body attack is cardio and interval training. And that's also done to music. So yeah, it's kind of like, you know, if you're coordinated and stuff, you can really get into it. Mm. And it's high octane. It's, you know, you sweat loads and you're absolutely wrecked afterwards. And that's how I like to go to the gym. you know, really, really hit it hard. Because otherwise, like, what's the point of going?
Do you remember going for your first class?
I do.
What were the feelings? Were you nervous?
No, God, no. Okay. No, no. So I did Irish dancing since I was five.
Yeah.
So that whole thing of going to a class is very natural to me. You know what I mean? Mm. Especially something where they're going to teach you something and then you have to try and mimic it. That's just second nature. And so my first class was Zumba, but it wasn't really Zumba. The American instructor said himself that he doesn't really do any Zumba steps. It was called, as he put it, and please try hard not to judge me here, funk fitness. Oh. Apple bottom jeans, boots with the fur.
Excellent. Like, yeah.
But yeah, I got mad into it.
Yeah.
So no, I had a great experience my first time.
Is there another universe where you are touring the world with Riverdance?
No. I was never that good. I liked Irish dancing. I like went to my classes twice a week, but I wasn't diligent enough to be practicing on the days that I wasn't in class. Mm. But I Irish danced at a time when if you had a natural ability, you could rise up to the ranks, you know, I won't say easy enough, but like, you know, there was an opportunity to, and I was lucky enough to. And so I did competitions certainly until I was like 22. But with regards to going off and doing shows, there weren't as many shows to join when I was 22. And also I went to university and that kind of took over. So I really just saw Irish dancing as this thing that I enjoyed, that kept me fit. And, you know, I could catch up with my friends from Irish dancing and stuff like that. But no, I never saw it as a career path necessarily. No.
So, you know, let's say you had that same attitude to acting where you didn't want to go and pursue it to be a professional actor, okay?
Yeah.
And you had that relationship where you did it as a kid and then you might have, you know, done it up until you were 22 and stuff in different like drama groups or whatever, you know, maybe like, you know, Dram Sock or whatever it was. Mm. And then you go and if you don't want to pursue it as a career, you go and you do like your Amdram and like that's what you do for the rest of your life in conjunction with your day job. Is there something like that with Irish dancing? Because I don't know of a culture where adults dance non-professionally. Am I just ignorant?
No, not at all. I'd never call you ignorant, Tom.
Thanks, man.
You can do, so Brenton DeGalley, who was a lead dancer with Riverdance, he kind of took over from Michael Flatley Colin Dunn took over from Michael Flatley, but he took over from Colin Dunn, I believe. He teaches adults Irish dancing in Dan's House every week. Oh. And they're really, really good classes because he caters them to suit your ability. So you can do his beginner class and then he has an intermediate 1 and 2. Mm. And then he's got advanced. So I went when I was kind of, because I'd retired 11 years before I wrote The Humours Abandoned. So I was really dancing unfit. And it's a different fitness. To be dancing fit is a whole different fitness to going to the gym.
Right.
I realised that soon. Mm. And so I went anyway to Dan's House and I joined Intermediate 2, thinking I won't quite jump in the deep end and go into advanced. And Intermediate 2 was really difficult. So yeah, it just gives you a kind of a... an indication of how well he caters for the people with different kind of abilities and stuff. But no, you can go do classes. And then I bumped into a girl only this week because I'm rehearsing in Liffey Trust Studios at the moment. So in my break time, we're in the couches and there was this girl in a kind of a Riverdance-y style Irish dancing costume, like kind of a short kind of velvet thing and black tights. And she was going into one of the studios. And then she was coming out intermittently and I was like, oh, what's the story? You're an Irish dancer. And she said she does this thing called Irish Dance Party. Mm. So she's employed by this guy called Dan, who set up this company maybe 10 years ago where visitors to Dublin and students and basically anyone who wants to have a go goes to do a sort of a day long all things Irish extravaganza. So he plays tin whistle and the guitar and he sings all the Irish songs and he tells a few Irish stories and then he gets an Irish dancer in to teach kind of ceilidh dances and then to do like little a cappella Irish dance themselves or maybe a hornpipe or something. So you get like a little flavour of all the different things that make us Irish. Well, in a kind of St. John and Gogarty's way. And so yeah, and then he said, I was chatting to him then when he came out and he said that there is no shortage of Irish dancers to choose from because so many people, they do it to such a high level now and then they're like, okay, what now? Like I have to keep dancing but I don't really want to dance in competitions because really you kind of retire when you're over the age 21. Mm. Like the competitions go like, you know, And you can do under five or under five, under six, under whatever, all the way up to under 21. And then over 21 is a category.
Right.
And it's kind of for those people that are like hanging on. But generally, like, other things take over then when you're like in your early 20s. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's time to give up. But then you're like, what do I do? What do I do? I'm brilliant at this really niche thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was one of them weird things. I did a little bit of touring with like an Irish dance company as a singer with them. But I like got to know dancers. But like, their life is hard. Like, I feel like they're totally like abused in the sense of like they are not paid proper, like in my experience anyway. I'm sure like different companies, but it just and like I don't know, it just, I'm sure they probably look at like actors or singers and say like, or like look at it like, how do you do that? But I was like, it was kind of mind blowing how quickly they were just expected to go in, pick it up, know it, you know what I mean? Like, my shit was easy, like, you know, you come in, you know the song, sure, but like, and then it was like, you know, hit your mark, that's fine, you're gonna get through it. But like tough life to me.
Yeah, but like, did any of them seem to be struggling with the new material?
No.
You see, that's it. It's second nature learning steps. And people observe Irish dancing in a way where they're like, what wizardry is this?
Yeah.
Whereas it's just second nature to us. They're like, I remember I did a show up in Belfast called My English Tongue, My Irish Heart in 2015. Mm. And myself and a Belfast actress called Kerry Quinn were part of the cast of six or five. And at one point, so it was all about kind of Irish emigrating to England and your kind of displaced sense of nationality and like who you are. And so kind of halfway through rehearsals, Martin Lynch, our director, found out that both myself and Kerry Quinn were Irish dancers. And he's like, oh, you have to do some dancing on the play. And I was like, grand, okay. So I said, what do you want to do here, Kerry? And there was just like, maybe 8-16 bars of music, and she's like, oh, how about we just do da 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 da. I was like, yeah. And then he's just watching us going, oh my god, I can't believe that's done now, you know. And then we danced and he was like, that was fucking that was fucking brilliant, you know. So yeah, it probably wasn't such a struggle for those dancers in the show to pick up the new material.
No.
And the fact that they got to dance full time and get paid for it, that's their dream.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, it wouldn't be difficult. I mean, obviously, everyone would love more money, but...
Totally.
They were employed as Irish dancers. I'm sure they were happy out.
Yes, indeed. Right, let's give another spin. All right, here we go. Number 39. Do you have it?
Yes.
Nice one. Sweet, you get to tick it off.
I get to tick it off.
You looked so expectant.
I'm like, what happens now?
Yeah, you
confetti.
Need five.
You need,
yeah.
Bingo.
No, you need five more then. Alright, here we go. Number 39. Oh my god, they're all health focused. Jeez, it looks like I'm trying to like intervene on your health or something. I just think you're really unhealthy. What is your biggest downfall when it comes to being healthy?
To being healthy, see, I've been pretty good lately. So my boyfriend's parents gave up kind of wheat, sugar, alcohol, you know, anything that's nice in this life, dairy, for health reasons, for different reasons I won't get into. But so then a couple of weeks ago, Rowan decided, hey, how about, you know, I'm going to give it a go. And I thought, well, fuck it, if you're going to go, like, maybe I will as well. So I've been really good lately. And I've discovered this thing, well, that his mother told us about, gram flour. Instead of, you know, pancakes your traditional way, you can buy gram flour, which is essentially just mashed up chickpeas, and you can get it for €2 in, like, for a kilogram in the Asian market there on St. William Street. And you just add a little bit of water and then whatever spice you want. So we put cinnamon in for kind of pancakes in the morning. So yeah, gram flour, a little bit of water, cinnamon, and delicious. Absolutely delicious. And like a lovely substitute for wheat. And I've noticed, like, well, like, I've lost weight without even trying. Well, like, I know that sounds like trying, but that wasn't my objective. I was just like, let's, you know, clean up the insides here a little. Yeah, so it's I have loads of energy and all those things, cliche things that people say. So my biggest downfall, certainly prior to that, would be evening times, obviously. Yeah, that sugar rush that kicks in when you get home. And in order to combat that, I wouldn't, you know, have any, you know, what do they call it, rubbish in the house. But then I would always, my snack of choice since I was a kid was always Ballymaloe Country Relish on crackers and cheese. Yeah, and I discovered that if you put cheddar cheese on your Jacob's cracker, Now, this is when, you know, crackers were basic enough. If you put your cheddar cheese on a Jacob's cream cracker and put it in the microwave, miraculously enough, the cheese will melt, but the cracker will stay crunchy. Now, you're welcome, right? But you put a little Ballymilly Country Relish on that, and that was essentially my diet for many years. Yeah, so yeah. It only took until I moved out of home in 2010 to kind of vary my culinary skills. And by vary, I mean I had three dishes. An omelette with black pudding in it.
Ooh.
Black pudding and like green pepper and tomatoes and whatever else is in there, maybe some sweet corn, which was kind of like a meal. And now I had one of them last week and I was so full. I was like, oh, that's why I wasn't shifted anyway when I was going to the gym, because I was having like this big meal in the morning. And what else did I cook? I had fried brown rice dish with whatever veg was in the fridge. And did I say I had three dishes? Just two, really.
Just two.
Yeah. And now since then, I've increased that tenfold.
Excellent.
I'm doing fish, Tom. I'm doing, I did onion bhajis, like, ooh, from scratch.
Lovely.
With this gram flour.
When's the dinner party, man?
I know. I'm actually, for the first time ever, I had people around and I cooked for them. Orla Fitzgerald, you know Orla Fitzgerald?
I don't know.
She's an actress, and herself and her husband Rich came over couple of weeks ago when I cooked for them, and then I cooked for my boyfriend's sister and her partner. So yeah, I'm changed now. So that's an old question for the old Mags.
Well, excellent. And with the new thing that you were doing with your fellas folks and yeah, and your boyfriend, are you off the drink at the moment as well?
I want to say yeah, but then I'm going to Norway with the Collapsing Horse tomorrow, so I don't know how long that's going to last. Like, I'm not a big drinker anyway. Sure. Like, I'm not one of these people that always has a drink in the fridge, like a glass of wine in the evening or beers or whatever. If I'm out on a night out, like, I'll certainly drink. But I wouldn't be out every weekend, certainly not recently. So I'm not a big drinker. So I haven't missed it. But yeah, obviously I'll be drinking when I go to Norway.
Yeah,
I'll be spending, what, €10 on a pint?
Stop, I know. But it'll probably be beautiful. It'll be great.
I don't know. I think we were getting our kind of itinerary breakdown from Matt Smith yesterday. He's like, so if you're bringing drink, you know, from London Gatwick to Norway, remember, you have to go through security. So just keep bear that in mind, you know, put it in your big case. And also, you know, do bring drink from Gatwick because it's so expensive in Norway.
Yeah. Right, bonkers, right.
Well,
you can report back in a couple of weeks.
Will
All
do.
Right, let's give it a spin. Okay, here we go. Number 10, do you have it?
No.
No worries. Number 10, the question is, do you have a favourite quote?
Do I have a favourite one? Oh.
Any ones that come back to pop into the mind?
It's easy to make decisions when you know what your values are.
Mm.
I always like that one.
That's excellent.
Since I read it on one of those calendars.
That's really good though.
Yeah, I love that one.
I think I could, yeah. That was a good one for me to hear today as well, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because decisions.
No,
but it's interesting, yeah, because even, you know, like... yeah, no, I suppose I'm just, you're trying to, you know, when you finish a job and then you got like space in your calendar and like you, things are popping up you can fill it with and you're like, do I want to do that? Or do I want to leave the space for, you know, something I really want to do? And
yeah,
it's interesting. Like that's always been a battle for me because I love being busy, you know,
yeah.
I love it and I love working. But then, you know, sometimes there are things that you don't necessarily need to be working on right now, and it might be better served just to have time to do your own projects and, you know, use that time for something you really believe in rather than just kind of
filling it for the sake of it.
Because that's one thing I realized about myself recently was like, I love the feeling of being busy, and like, you know, like recently I was at a funeral and, you know, people are always asking you, they're like, oh, so what's next? You know, like any social gathering like that. And it's lovely when you can, I love the feeling of being able to say, well, this and that and wrapping up in a nice little bow, because that feels nice. But it's not necessarily a good way, like that's a terrible reason to be busy, to have something to say.
Yeah, but that's not, that probably wouldn't be your objective, or that probably wouldn't be why you're saying that.
No, it wouldn't. But like now I'm trying to be a bit more choiceful about what I'm doing, and I'm for the first time probably like since I've been out of drama school, I've been confronted with that thing of just trying to say, oh, nothing, and being okay with that
and sitting into
that's
it.
Hard for me.
Yeah. Well, you do seem to be a very busy person, and certainly you're this podcast has been going for so many episodes. I was having a little look back. I was like, oh my God.
We're nearly at 100.
Really? Yeah. That's amazing. Nearly at 100. You know? Yeah. And even like when, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but like the email came in to do it and I was in the cinema and like it was, you'd send me the kind of first contact via social media and then you're like, if you have your email address. And as soon as you got my email address, you were straight on it. And then right. like, here are our time slots. And they were for like a couple of days time. It's like, boom, 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 boom. I was like, oh, wow, that must be why he gets so much done.
Yeah. Interesting. That's funny that it comes across like that. Yeah. And was that, did you find that like, impressive, not like too much or intimidating or intense.
Impressive.
That's good. Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Well, I was delighted you did it because it's funny. You have this. It's weird with like doing the podcast and for having so many episodes. Because I think I got to like 40 and I was like, and then sometimes you feel like, oh, I'm running out of people. And then it's amazing because then you start meeting people. I think like the first time I would have been aware of you, but I think the first time we met was at the Fish Amble writing day.
That's right.
I think I'm right in saying that. Yeah. And then you're like, oh yes, this would be great because I'd seen your brilliant show, The Humorous Bandit. Yeah, I did. Yeah, and loved it. And so yeah, it's really funny how like it's kind of like something like this could probably actually go forever, and you'd probably find interesting people to like talk to. I'd say for like much longer than you'd anticipate.
Do you have an end point in sight?
I'm going to hit 100.
Okay.
I'm going to hit 100.
You're going to hit 100. Great. And you will too.
Yeah, really. Soon. Like probably, definitely before Christmas.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely.
What a milestone. You should celebrate that.
Yeah. And then I'll kind of touch base with it because it was funny, Angus was in, and obviously Angus has the brilliant Irish theatre podcast. And
series up to like 49?
Yeah, 50, like so like we actually probably have a almost identical number. Nearly, I'd say his is spread out a little bit more, but he was talking about that and he was like, I've always been afraid of being like the interview guy because that's not what he wants to be and nor is it really what I want to be. It's fun talking to people though, and you know, it's fun to put stuff out.
So
it's interesting, but I love doing it. And even what I was saying to you, it's lovely to just switch off your phone and sit in front of someone that you don't know particularly well and kind of just get on the same level and get to know them a bit better.
Yeah,
that's a lovely thing.
For sure. Yeah.
I don't even know if we answered your question, but
we did. You asked me for my favorite quote, and I said it's easy to make decisions.
And I said I needed it, so then I just made it all about myself.
Ah no, it was good. It was good. Changed it up a bit.
Yeah, right. Let's give it a spin. All right, here we go. Number 26. Do you have it?
No, I don't.
No worries. Number 26. The question is, what is your most treasured relationship with someone over the age of 65?
Oh, lovely. Lovely. Well, he's just about there because he's 65.
Yeah.
But my mum's first cousin is a guy called Noel McCarthy. Mm. And Noel was heavily involved in amateur theatre, still is, for his whole working life. So when he left school, he went into the bank. Mm. And that was Dublin back in the 70s, would that be right? Mm. But then he would always say that theatre, and he pronounces it theatre, which I love.
I love that as well.
Theatre was my mistress, you know. And he would do his full day work in Bank of Ireland, then go straight into La Touche Players, which was a kind of a drama group set up by Bank of Ireland. They used to operate out of, do you know, Central Bank? They used to have the Wax Museum in there.
Yeah.
That's where La Touche Players used to put on their shows and stuff. But even before that, like he did the one act festival circuit and the full length plays and everything like that. So I didn't always know I wanted to be an actor. I kind of came across it when I was 17. I played a part in Candide, the Leonard Bernstein's Scottish opera, for Belvedere College. And you know the way they look for females to play their female parts and stuff like that. So I had a part in that and I absolutely loved it. It was 2000 and it was a great year for Max.
Yeah.
It was the opening of the O'Reilly Theatre. So it was the first kind of show that was going in there. And I got high off it. So then I had a look at the CAO and I was like, oh God, you know, I think I really want to do this. And Mom was, well, as supportive as an Irish parent would be, she's like, you know, maybe, you know, yeah. Well, maybe do a degree and then, you know, get the bit of paper. And then, you know, you can always do acting outside of that. And I was like, yeah. So I did. I did the degree. But after I finished, so I spent most of my time in DCU. I did multimedia in DCU.
Excellent.
Which was a creative course. You know, it was audio visual, audio imaging, or sorry, digital imaging, digital audio, digital video, and web production, web design. And it was 2001 to 2005. So it was like things were just starting to kick off then. I remember one of our video lecturers was like telling us that we were going to be watching videos on our phone in the next 5 years. And I was like, he's a crazy lunatic. But anyway, I digress. I spent most of my time at ECU Drama. So when I finished, I needed to fill that void. And Noel, I met at my aunt's funeral in 2005, like properly as an adult. I'm sure I met him as a kid. And Noel's again, he was just kind of surveying me, you know, he was kind of looking at me, you know, in the room. And he was like, what's your story now? And I was like, well, I just finished college and I don't really know. I said, I think I want to be an actor. And he went, bullshit. And I was like, I want to be an actor. He went, bullshit. I was like, no, I do. I want to be an actor. And my voice nearly came down in tone the more he made me like really know that that is like, if that's something that I wanted to do, I needed to fucking announce it, you know, and kind of stick up for myself or stick up for it or something. And then he just went, are you any good? And I said, yeah, I think I am. And he just kind of, he kept moving towards me, kind of bellying me into the corner, like, and are you any good? And are you any good? And I was like, Jesus. So he said, come down next Tuesday. Latouche are doing an open audition for their latest show that they're taking on to the One Act Festival circuit. And come down and we'll see if you're any good. And I went down the following Tuesday and I got cast in The Fat Lady Sings a Little Grimly. And we did it in, like, we did a few different venues all around the country. And there were kind of festival awards in each of the venues. And I won like best supporting actress in one of them. And I was like, oh, you know, other people think I'm good too. And he's someone whose opinion I just put on high, because nobody in the family, none of them are really interested in the performing arts. And if they do go to see plays, it's because I'm in them and stuff like that. And my mum would often say, like, since I was a child, she'd say, you know, you were born into the wrong family. You know that, you know, like, yeah, yeah. And so he just seemed to get it, you know. And so when I decided to go at it full time and I said I wanted to do training, he tried to dissuade me actually from doing the training. He said, you know, get your job and do it in the evenings and I'll do plays with you. And he just didn't want me to let go of that financial security, I guess. Yeah. But I was like, no, I want to do it full time and I want to go training. And so he helped me out with my audition pieces. I went to RADA. I got through to the third round of RADA with his help. And he, like, I'd go up to the teacher's club and we'd take a room up there and he'd do hours with me, you know, like 3 hours easy after work. And be so energized even at the end of the 3 hours, you know, because I'd be doing a line and be like, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. So I cherish our relationship. He was like, when I was away traveling, I went traveling around the world when I left DCU because I knew I'd never be able to take that year out again. And I was in deep in the like the back arse of nowhere in Cambodia. And I went to see a kind of I suppose they called him like a very, very holy monk, but he had like a gift. And we had an interpreter there because we were staying with this girl who worked with an interpreter and she was teaching them about conservation in the villages. And he said, what do you want to know about? And I said, career, says the traveler. I said, career. And he said, you have a father-like figure in your life who's going to help you out in that regard. And then I just immediately thought of Noel, you know. And so, yeah, he's always been very supportive towards me. Certainly, I did my training and he goes to see my shows. But outside of that, like, we meet up and I just love chatting to him about theatre and about life. And we just get on so well. I'm absolutely mad about him, yeah.
You know what you said about your mum saying you're born into the wrong family?
Yeah.
And obviously, I assume that was meant like in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way. Like, you know.
No.
No, she hates me.
No, not that. Just like, she doesn't know where I came from. Like,
Yeah. Do you ever feel like, what's your sense that, are you glad that your family don't really get it? Or is there like ever a loneliness where you kind of would love to be like, just sit down at your mom and dad and tell them about something very specific to the industry that really people who have no connection with it wouldn't really get? Like, do you find comfort in that or a loneliness in that?
I think it's a good question, but I don't think there's an answer for it. Because it's the way it is.
Sure.
So I know certainly throughout, I'll answer it in the kind of way that I see her involvement in my Irish dancing as it progressed, which was zero, you know, other than like being stalwart in terms of giving me lifts and like providing the money for costumes and shoes and all the rest and competitions. She'd be sitting in the car and reading her book. She tinnitus in her. She has tinnitus in her left ear. So she's reading her book in the car. And the deal was I'd go out and I'd tell her when I was dancing so that she wouldn't have to sit through the entire competition. So this is the early days now when she actually brought me to the competitions, because as I got a bit older then, my Irish dancing teacher knew that she had no interest and said, look, I'll bring her. So my Irish dancing teacher used to bring me to everything. But anyway, she'd be sitting in the car and I'd go out to the car and I'd knock on the window. She rolled down the window and I'd be like, Mom, I'm dancing in 5 minutes. She looked at me and she'd go, is it 5 now or is it 10? She did not need to be there any longer than possible, than was absolutely necessary. And then I had a friend, Kathy Milliken, and her mom was extremely kind of dedicated and knew exactly what she was looking at when she went to the competitions. It was heavily involved. And, herself and her sister used to come home on a Sunday night and talk about the competitions with their mom and who got what and all of that. Mm. Like, and my mom didn't have a clue. And certainly from what you asked me there, I did feel when I was younger, oh, like I'd love if mom would be like, come on now, you're practicing, because maybe then I'd be, you know, maybe then I'd practice. But sure, that's not going to make you practice. It is what it is. And in a way, I kind of really appreciate that she still was so supportive towards me, even though she had no interest in it. Mm. And kind of, you can't expect your parent or your family to be interested in the same things that you are, because isn't that the most wonderful thing, that you all have different interests? It's also the thing that like might annoy you by day 3 at Christmas time when you're like all living under one roof. You're like, oh my God, I'm a middle child again. No one gets me. But that's it's good, it's grounding, and it adds colour to your life to go back to your family and to not have a clue. So my brother's doing clinical psychology, so he'd have fascinating kind of viewpoints on things. And then my sister works in the hospitality industry, so she's like got stories to beat the band about that side of things. My mom is a nurse, you know. My dad was a pilot. My aunts are teachers. So it was all like everyone has their thing that they're good at, and we're not all expected to be all things to all people.
So you've made acting your thing and writing to an extent as well. So like, do you, sometimes I wonder about this with myself maybe, it's like, is there any part of you that is the reason that you chose this career is still like that way of like trying to pull, you know, your mom's attention? Like, am I doing basic bitch psychology here?
No. I mean, I'd say you're trying there, all right?
Yeah, I am. I'm doing my best.
No. It's not like, look at me. Sure, I'm the only one in the family with red hair. Like, that was looked after. Mom tells a story of my first Irish dancing class. Right. And I know I keep bringing it back to Irish dancing, but in a way it's kind of, because that's that side of my life is finished, it's easier to kind of look back and observe. And I guess our approach to things doesn't change, so it's kind of easy. So that's why I keep going back to it. My first Irish dancing class, she was only kind of advised to put me in Irish dancing because she said I was a very clumsy child. Me eating my food, it'd be all over me. I'd be running around, I'm tripping over my feet. Now I'm like, I was 5 as well. So I think she kind of jumped the gun a little. But anyway, she got advice. She said she didn't want me starting school and having the other kids slag me for being clumsy. And she said, and you already had the red hair. And I was like, sound. So she got advice to send me to Irish dancing. So reluctantly, as far as she's concerned, because she had no interest in, you know, wouldn't know a reel from a jig or, you know, and the music annoyed her. But she'd brought me down to my Irish dance class anyway. And an hour later, she came to collect me. And I was sitting cross-legged. And I was staring up at the stage. And she said, come on now, Margaret, it's time to go. And I was like, Mommy, the big girls are on the stage. And the teacher came over and said, oh God, like, if you want to just leave her there and do your messages, collect your son or whatever, she's going to be fine because I've got the intermediate starting now and like I'll keep an eye on her. So Mom did, and she went off and she came back. She said, an hour later and you hadn't moved. And it was like, mommy, you know, the big girls are on the stage. And she said she knew in that moment, oh, there's some, this, the, you know, this is something that she is going to be very passionate about that I don't understand, but I'm going to do what I can to support her. Mm. So, yeah, it's not like I think as kids, we're, if we're lucky, and I am extremely lucky, we're kind of open to loads of different avenues and activities and stuff. And mom would throw us into everything to see what stuck and was delighted in what stuck. So okay. For me, it was Irish dancing. And essentially, I think, coming back to my basic psychology, is that it was the performance. It was the big girls are on the stage. It was the performance element. With my brother, it was tennis. And mom was delighted when something stuck. Because she said, you know, especially my brother in the tennis, you know, she said if he came in from school and he was having a bad day and, you know, he'd go out and he'd play a game of tennis and he'd come back in then and he'd totally relaxed. And that's it. And me on a Tuesday night, I'd be fighting. Myself and my brother used to fight like cats and dogs. We go to Irish dance. I go to Irish dancing and I come back at 9 o'clock and everything was right in the world. And she loved that. Mm. That's the thing. Like she says, and she says to this day, if you go back to what used to make you happy when you were a very young child, that will always bring you peace. So for her, whenever she'd go to her granddad's house, she would like pull up in the car and she wouldn't even go to the house. She'd run into the woods and she'd go exploring. And certainly when we were growing up, she was always very fit and she'd play badminton and tennis and all of that. And then it was only after kind of many years, I think she turned about 60, just before 60, she joined a kind of a walking group, and they used to go to Glendalough and arrange trips and stuff like that, and she started walking and now there's no stopping her. Really? She is, oh my god, she's done Machu Picchu, she goes to the Alps, she wants to do base camp Kilimanjaro. She is like so passionate about walking and hiking, and she just kind of smiles to herself going, God, I always knew it. Like as in, I used to love when I was a kid. And of course, that's the thing that brings me peace now, you know. And she's like 65 now.
Yeah.
She absolutely lives for it. So no, I wouldn't say I did it in order to get to for her to get attention from her. It was just, I was really supported in finding a passion and following it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's gorgeous. All right, let's give it a spin. All right, here we go. Number 12. Do you have that one?
No, I don't.
No worries. Number 12. Do you ever wish you were born as the opposite gender?
No.
No.
No. Like, you'd be curious, all right. I remember doing a piece for in the Gaiety in second year. We did Manifesto. I'm sure you've heard of Manifesto class.
Yeah.
And the piece I did was taking off this kind of... it was a guy called Dimitri, and people can like YouTube this, but he is meant to have been out on a night out and have met a woman, and she gave him her number, and this is the voice message that he sends her, and then she doesn't reply, and then the second bit of it is the next message he sends her after she hasn't replied, and it's an absolute scream, and I took it for face value. I thought it was a real thing, and I was subsequently found out it was completely fabricated. But I thought, this is brilliant, and I'm just going to, this is my piece, I'm going to do this, you know, as it exists. So I was playing this guy, you know, and this really, really cocksure, arrogant, kind of stubborn, like, prick, basically. And I decided to ask one of the guys in my class, Kevin Shackleton, I was like, can I, you played rugby, can I get that like shield thing off you? And he's like, all right. So I put the shield thing on and I stuffed it with a sock or whatever. And I had, you know, slacks on and stuff like that. And I was just kind of walking around the space trying to get into character. And I was like, I know this sounds terrible, but I was like, I'm so powerful. Like, I'm just like, it's right there, and yeah, what about it, you know? Now that's very rudimentary and it's very basic, because I feel powerful as a woman too, of course.
Sure.
But I did think for that day, I was like, it'd be fun to switch maybe for a week. Yeah, so I think it'd be fun to switch for a week, but be born as another sex, nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
Because I mean, it's just one of them it's probably always fascinating, but like at the moment, just like the way like gender roles and the way like, you know, just
just with all, like, I mean, I'm not going to come into all the different movements, but like, it's just things have been really like drastically changing over the, like, you know, with just, I mean, like all the scandals and allegations and all like the really brilliant stuff. It's a real fascinating time, I'm sure, to be a woman. It's a fascinating time to be a man as well.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, especially like a young man, because, you know, I don't have maybe the disadvantage that like my father or my grandfather might have of like having, you know, years of being brought up in a system where like a lot of those negative patriarchal behaviours were left unchallenged. Like, for me, I've kind of grown up where like I would have seen them being quite consistently challenged, so you're maybe a little bit more aware. Like, I've grown up with a little bit more awareness. It's a really fascinating time though, because even at that, you're still constantly kind of looking around, and you see it with your different friend groups, whether it be friends from home or friends, you know, maybe within like the artistic community or whatever, and like the differences. It's really interesting that, like, because it's just, it's certainly for me, it's really on like the forefront of everything, because I mean, societally and on social media and everything, it's kind of right there too. Like, it's one of them things. I don't wish I was born the opposite gender too, but like, it would probably be a really good exercise to see what it was like, you know.
Well, would you have to be born as the opposite sex? Could you not just exist as the opposite sex for like a while?
Yeah,
you know, maybe not a week, I don't know. But,
yeah.
And because if you're born as it, you'd never know any difference.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But it's funny. I obviously welcome all those movements as they came to pass, and had kind of had seen misogyny before Waking the Fem. You know, I'd seen it from, I'd say my, became aware of it really my late 20s. You know, and then once it's like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And it was everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was on every billboard. It was every comment when you were into work, when you went to work. And you just kind of put up with things as you did in that wonderfully strong way. And then when the movement started to gain traction and people were becoming really, really vocal, I certainly, I welcomed that change. But also, I don't feel like a consistent level of anger, or I don't feel hard done by that I was born a woman. And I know that certainly I'm maybe I'm gullible, or maybe I let things go over my head. But I kind of enjoy that about myself. I remember I did one of those kind of videos for Vote With Us for the marriage equality referendum. And it wasn't to diminish my point or anything, but I was talking about being born with red hair and would be getting slagged for having red hair, obviously. We all have our thing. And but I never understood why calling me a redhead was a slag in itself. It would be like, you red hair, ah, ha, ha. And I would like, and you've blonde hair. I don't get why that's funny. That's funny and that isn't. You know, like, I never understood it. So in a way, like, blissfully unaware, like I have lived my life as a woman, and I'm sure there have been kind of comments made about me that wouldn't have been made about me had I not been born a woman, but they weren't said to my face. And thankfully, I have grown up confident enough to speak up for myself if they ever were. And I certainly got a name for myself. So I worked as a waiter in lots of different restaurants for about 10 years. And I remember when Waking the Feminist happened, I was asked to speak on behalf of Lisa Turney-Coe, who couldn't be present that day. And she had written a lovely piece. And so I was lucky enough to be performing on the stage, surrounded by all these really like powerful, intelligent, creative, like fascinating women. And then looking out into the Abbey, and it was sold out, and everyone was there smiling back at you and support. Like, not even smiling. There was an electric energy in the room that day. We all felt it. But I remember particularly Grace Dias stood up to respond towards the latter end. And she said, I want to know what practical steps we can make today. So this is all very well and good that we're being vocal, but what can we do from here on in? Like, what steps can we take? And she said, I know myself that no longer am I going to let that sort of stuff fly. So if I hear comments or whatever, I'm going to stand up for myself, even if it makes me difficult, or even if people are going to be talking about me. And I remember like listening to her, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do that too. So the next time I went into the restaurant, one of the lads in the kitchen say something about one of the customers, and I pulled them up on it, and they're like, "All right, tetchy," and I was like, "No," and I made that change, right? And then after a while, I mean, they loved taking the piss anyway, and that's kind of like they were very kind of fun loving kitchen staff, or chef staff, so they were always looking for a joke and a way to take the mick out of you. So I became known as this like angry feminist, and so they'd like ham it up if I came into the kitchen. Like, oh no, we can't talk about that now. Would you look who's after walking in? And I didn't mind that. I was like, yeah, you can say what you like. But then the best thing happened. So right before I left, I was sitting down with the head chef and owner of the restaurant, and we had had our lunch, and his chefs had gone back to the kitchen to start prepping for dinner. And he goes, because he had two daughters. Mm. He had a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. And the 6-year-old loves pink and frills and writing in her notebooks, and was wearing, I think, white sparkly boots, little cowboy boots she wanted to wear for her communion dress and all of that. She got so into it. And his 4-year-old wanted a GA jersey for her birthday, and she wanted to become a fire person when she was grown up. And he goes, I'm looking for a new chef in the kitchen. I was like, all right. And he said, yeah, I've been trying to look for a girl, actually. I was like, really? He goes, yeah, just, you know, it'd be good to like change it up a bit. I was like, fucking brilliant. And he goes, because the young one, she wants to be a fire person when she grows up. And like, there's no reason why she shouldn't be able to do that. And he knew he could talk to me about this. And yeah. I just thought, you know what? My work here is done. That's all it takes, is just you to kind of, even if you have to withstand a few little jibes and stuff like that, the movement is happening because people are open to change. Mm. And I don't see like an us and them. I don't see like the kitchen staff at that time as my enemy, and I was on this side and they were on that side. Sure, they were like pulling fun and stuff like that, but they were also, with every kind of thing I said, they were like opening their mind up a little bit every time. And now I don't know, I'm really enjoying the open discourse now, but there's no anger and there's no bitterness on, like, certainly from my side. On the issue,
yeah, which is so lovely, because like, as in, and obviously like the anger and bitterness, like it's totally understandable, because if you feel like you've been repressed your whole life, fucking hell, fair enough. Like, it's not something I don't understand what that's like, so I'd never police anyone's emotions on it. But as you said, like, it is just, I think it's so much more conducive to like open discourse, because, you know, and again, you don't want to fall into the trap of like making excuses for people who've been like perpetrating misogyny. But at the same time, if people do feel attacked, then they go into defensive mode and they'll go back to what they always know. Mm. You know what I mean? It's very hard to have an open heart if you feel like you're going to get crucified. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So like, it's, yeah, that's a gorgeous story, where, and it's amazing how the universe can sometimes do that as well. Like that, I don't want to get all like earthy about it, but like that,
no,
man,
I love all that stuff.
But he was given two daughters, and like, I mean, then one of them suddenly wants to go into a job that like stereotypically is probably a very male dominated industry. Mm, yeah. And I mean, it just, you know, it forces him to tilt his perspective. I mean, that's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely is. When it's life affirming. Yeah, but that he's open to that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Which is which is
he's
so
a
lovely.
Wonderful person.
Right. Let's give it a spin. All right, here we go. Whoa, very popular role there. All right, we have number 9. Do you have it?
No, I don't.
No worries. Number 9. The question is, in your industry, who is a person that you haven't yet worked with and you would love to?
Oh, so many.
I know.
So many.
Who was the first name that came into your head?
Like, the first name that came to my head, I never like to go with the first option. because it's just the obvious one.
Sure.
Like, I've never worked with Druid. But then I just think of the amount of people. But that's just like we're nearly not conditioned to say that, but like, that's just something that comes to the forefront of your imagination when you're asked a question like that. But I would love to work with, so I did a reading. I did a reading in the Lear, the master's program of playwriting. Mm. And I was just hired in to do the reading to kind of demonstrate their work. And Una Murphy directed it. And I remember getting on really well with her in the rehearsal room. I thought she was so astute, so smart, so open. and just I put a lovely finish on everything. Yeah, so I really enjoyed working with her. I've auditioned for her before, so yeah, I think I would enjoy working with Una. Who else? I'm working at the moment with Dan Colley, who's somebody that I've wanted to, who I would have answered with if you talked to me maybe 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Which is great. I love the way he works. It's he's so generous with the ideas of whatever's floating around in the room at the time, and he'll do things like, "Oh, what you said there, just put this in mind. Do you know this video? Blah blah blah." And it's not necessarily related to the work, but it came into his head for a reason, and he's going with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way my mind works too. And so when I had a moment like that, he would like be really really open to see where that went.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I'm really, really enjoying working with him.
What are the things that people you enjoy? Can you spot things, whether that be like on stage or actors or directors or writers, whatever it might be? Can you see a common thread of like traits or things that that you're attracted to, or like you think make a good director, or you think make a good actor?
I think in terms of direction, I personally really enjoy when they display a confidence in terms of knowing what the show is. Now, that isn't to say that I want them to have everything worked out before day one, nothing like it, but that they will demonstrate a kind of a forethought of a direction they want it to go, at least. If I go into a rehearsal room with somebody who is just feeling everything out and is working in that sort of like, well, I don't know, let's just see what happens. I don't know if it's like the Irish dancer in me, but I'm like, yeah, but what's the step?
Yeah.
I don't really, I think I feel like I'm just kind of in the murky waters there. I don't know if I trust myself in those situations. I think that's more the point.
Yeah.
I like people to take charge and not, you know, say this here and go there and do that, but they have to know what's the vibe, what's the kind of flavor, what's the color that they want for the particular production. Yeah,
totally. So it was just interesting what you said there about, like, you know, the first one that came to your head was Druid, and you're like, in a way we're conditioned to do that. I completely empathize with that. What's your relationship with your own career, in the sense of, like, obviously, you know, you did something like Show in a Bag, which is obviously an amazing opportunity for anyone, and then your show was like particularly successful and, you know, is still running this day, which is amazing. You've done stuff on the Abbey stage with Anna Karenina and all that kind of stuff. What is your relationship with your career in terms of, like, I know sometimes we can see it as like a dirty word, but like ambition and what you want to do going forward? Because obviously those two things, like to have a, you know, like a, let's be frank about it, like a hit show that you've written, like that would be on a lot of people's bucket lists, I'm sure, and to be on the Abbey stage, again, on a lot of people's bucket lists. How do you look at what you want to do going forward, having achieved those two things in the kind of recent past?
Interesting question. I think writing Humours Abandon was something that I did when I was going through an involuntary hiatus, we'll say, in my acting. It was in 2016, and I had worked with Rough Magic in 2013. We did Digging for Fire. And then 2014, I was touring with Jezebel with Rough Magic. So we went to London and Paris and all over Ireland. And I Glasgow as well, I think. And I remember going, oh my God, like our first date on the tour was in the lovely Backstage Theatre in Longford. And we walked in, and they're so nice there. They have like a plate of sandwiches ready for you. And warm smiles. Oh my God, they're so gorgeous. And I was in the change room, and they're like, and there's your towel. And the change room is just adorned with like posters of all different shows. And, you know, you can smell the people that have been in there, not in a gross way, but in a, you know, kind of awe-inspiring way. And Valerie O'Connor, who was playing Jezebel, she left to go talk to Peter or something. I was in the dressing room on my own, and I was looking in the mirror, and I started crying with happiness. And Val came in, she's like, oh, Mags, are you all upset? And I was like, no, I'm just really happy. And that was, for me, I was like, okay, now, you know, after doing profit share. So I graduated in 2010, and I did profit share shows for 3 years, and then this Digging for Fire was a great opportunity for me, And I was so grateful to Lynn for kind of, well, as she wasn't directing the show, Matt Tourney was directing the show and associate director was Rough Magic, but for them taking a punt on a kind of an unknown actress, I didn't have an agent at the time and I really, really appreciated working with them. And then when it got to Jezebel, I was like, okay, now I'm on tour with Rough Magic. Okay, now things are really going to take off. And I don't know what take off meant, but it just meant my objective has always been to go from job to job to job. I'm sure you've heard that answer a million times before. And then after Jezebel, that was it. Like, as in for a while. 2015, then I did my English Tongue, Irish Heart, which took me up to Belfast. And I got to know a whole different circle of people up there and support networks. And I thought, wow, like there's so much going on up here. This is very interesting. And we were up there for a while. And then we did a tour down the west coast of Ireland. And then we went to London and Manchester. And then after that finished, I was offered a job in the New Theatre, which I turned down, actually. It was the first time I turned down work. It was like a straight job offer. And I read the script and I thought, this isn't ready yet. And I don't think I'd enjoy going in to rehearse this. And again, it's easy to make decisions when you know what your values are. I thought, I value my time more than going in to work on this. So I'm gonna turn it down. And that was scary, right? Because I was like working as a waitress and couldn't wait for my next acting gig. And here it was, and it wasn't even an audition, it was a job offer. And I turned it down. I was like, well, now we're very scared. So I worked in the restaurant that Christmas, and then coming into 2016, I had nothing on the horizon. And I was very down, and I still didn't have an agent. I was just like, what in the name of God am I gonna do here? And then the show in a bag deadline was looming. And I was like, do you know what? I'll just write this. So I wrote it because of reasons other than, oh, I really want to write. So I wrote the show and I didn't think it was any good. I remember it. Stephanie Preisner directed it, who I trained with in the Gage School of Acting. And she wasn't actually going to direct it initially. I wanted Ronan Phelan to do it. And he was going to be on tour in the Abbey. Or in with the Abbey in America. And so he couldn't do it. And then I said, well, Stephanie thinks. And he's like, why did you ask Stephanie? And in one of those weird moments, she rang the next morning and was like, so what did Ronan say? I was like, well, he had a crazy idea. He said you might direct it. And she was like, yeah, go on. So we did it. She had a very tight schedule. So we kind of worked out, you know, little pockets here and there that she could direct it. So she directed. Anyway, I'm waffling now. But 2 weeks before it went up, we went to get a tea break. We were rehearsing in Fringe. And she's like, what's wrong with you? You're really quiet. And I said, the play is shit, Stephanie. And I'm awful in it. And I've wasted the last 6 years of my life. That's where I'm at the moment. And she's like, okay. I could stand here and convince you that you're wrong. But I've more respect for your intelligence than that. I know it's going to go in one ear and out the other. You're not going to start believing in the show until it's up in front of an audience. But until then, we've work to do. So come on. So it was the best thing for me. There was none of this rubbing my back. Oh, no, it is good. None of that. She was like, tough love. Come on. Yeah. Let's do it. So in performing it in rehearsals, I was scarlet. I was embarrassed. I thought, this is just not good, you know. And then it went up in front of an audience and they really connected with it. And I thought, there's something in this. And the first preview I tried, now I got myself out of it and stuff, but like I wasn't really that over the moon with it. But then the second performance, the opening night, went really well. And I was energized by it. I've never felt in my life how I felt when I came off after opening night of Humour's Abandon in the Fringe in 2016. It was a game changer. And I say that because directly after that, I got Anna Karenina, and it was a job offer that came in following from Humour's Abandon, actually. And I thought, I remember getting the news. I was cycling down Georgia Street. Shouldn't have been on my headphones, but I was. And it was Kelly Phelan at the time. And she's like, oh, I want to offer you a part in Anna Karenina. And I was cycling at the time, as I said. So I was just like, sorry, what's that? Do you want me to audition for Anna Karenina? And she went, no, no, it's a job offer, Howard. Well, that's very good. And I got off the phone and I bawled crying with happiness again. And I thought, this is it, because I wanted to be on stage and I'd gate the Abbey within 5 years of leaving drama school. And here it was. And I remember opening night of Anna Karenina, standing backstage, and I thought, God, this is the thing that I've been aiming towards. But I felt infinitely more energized and more excited and more inspired on the smallest stage in Dublin, performing The Humour's Abandoned, than I do right now. Like, I certainly enjoyed my time doing Anna Karenina, but it wasn't anything like how I felt when I was performing The Humour's Abandoned. So I now trust that.
And why?
So why? There's something in when you write something and create it yourself and perform it, you're really like opening yourself up to huge criticism, first of all. You're wearing your heart in your sleeve in a way that I do when I talk to people, like when I communicate with people. I'm very, very open, maybe too honest. But that's who I am. And that's how I'm best able to express myself when I'm doing a show like Humours. And when I'm part of a team in Anna Karenina, it all works. It all runs very well. I'm a great team player, and I'll definitely, I'll never miss my cues, and I'm very, very diligent. And I had I had loads of ins and outs and costume changes. I think about 15 costume changes, and them all color coded, and I pasted them over the back of the wall. And you know, like, I was in work mode, but it was nearly like I was in 101 Talbot, and I had, you know, a very busy section that night or something. Do you know, like, it was, I'm working here, but Humours was something else. Humours was a real passion project. And that isn't to say you can make a career doing passion project after passion project. You certainly can't. But in order to answer the question of what my objectives are for the future, not that I tend not to have them. It's just that I'm open to seeing. I never could have envisaged that I would write something else. And now I'm writing another play. Yeah. But if you asked me that maybe 5 years ago, that never would have been my answer. So I think it's really important to be open to what comes your way and to really see how you're feeling at the time and trust that and let that shape it. Mm-hmm. You know, let your career go that way if it wants to. So I'm writing one of the a play for Ireland, plays for Fish Amble. And I've decided to give myself a very daunting task of writing for 7 people. Right. And not one, and that is really difficult. But I wanted that. I wanted the challenge, and I wanted to like really dive into something and challenge myself. And it certainly is that. And I also had another idea that I got some funding for from the Dunleary Patron Artist Bursary. So I'm doing that as well. And a film production company, are interested in turning Humours Abandoned into a feature.
Excellent.
So I also have that to be thinking of as well. So yeah, I definitely have objectives with regards to my acting. I'd love to do more, but at the moment I'm happy to see where the writing takes me to.
Mm. And that's really exciting with the humour. Well, all of it's really exciting, but with the Humours Abandoned and like the possibility of a feature film, is that something that you would be also writing the screenplay for? Or
yeah, well, initially when it was put to me, they said we have writers in mind. And I was like, yeah. And I chatted to Stephanie about it. And she's like, well, how do you feel about that? And I said, well, and she's like, say it. I was like, well, I'd kind of like to write it. And she's like, well, then say that. So I was like, shaking, writing the email. Is it okay? And yeah, they were very supportive about that notion. I think it might slow things up a little, certainly. But I thought, you know, Humours Abandoned was loosely based on my dancing career. Certainly, well, the last third was completely made up, but 2/3 of it anyway. Mm. And that's 18 years of my life. And so if I just had someone else kind of getting the bullet point details, they wouldn't colour it in the way that I know it to be.
Yeah.
That it's so important for it to be done. And certainly if it's going to connect with an Irish dancing audience, you have to get the little details right.
Yeah.
And that's, I found in writing Humours, I thought it was going to be not very relatable to most people because it's based on something so niche. But I found in being extremely detailed about creating this world, it made it infinitely relatable. Because I had people coming up to me afterwards going, oh my God, it was just like my old swimming meets. Or your teacher was just like my piano teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
So hopefully the film goes the same way.
And it's funny because like even I've never met Stephanie, but like the two, you've spoken about her twice there, and she'd be someone
One of the things that I'd love to see going forward is to like is to write for TV and to do something kind of comparable to what she would have done with Can't Cope, Won't Cope. But it's so interesting because I remember hearing her speak. I think it was on a podcast, an Irishman Abroad podcast.
Yes,
I'm not sure
Jarlath,
if you listeners, Jarlath's one, yeah. And I thought it was fascinating because she was talking, you know, very openly just about like some of the frustrations she had about her experience, like with writing it, in the sense of it was those little things that like she felt that she, you know, that because I guess. It was interesting drawing that comparison of her being like, well, would you like to write it? Well, tell them that. And, you know, it was interesting then hearing her is like, I might have liked to have been there because I might have been able to give better instruction of like, it was some, I can't remember, but it was something in the shower.
Yes,
maybe it was like some of the shampoo.
Two bottles of shampoo. And she said, no, if you're like living with your best friend, you just have one bottle of shampoo.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You know?
And I was like, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
like, that's what
yeah.
it is. Like, that's the little things that like, that make it real for you, or they don't. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
For sure.
It's amazing, yeah.
Think about the movie, oh my God, I brought this up the other day, that's why it just came to mind.
Yeah.
Green Card.
Okay.
With Andrew McDowell and that French actor, what's his name? Gérard Depardieu?
Yes.
Gérard Depardieu?
Very good. Well, I enjoyed that.
No, I've just said Gérard Depardieu. No, Max. But the whole, it's a brilliant movie from the 90s, and they have to prove that they are actually in a relationship, and they're only marrying for a green card, but they have to like plead their case or convince their case officer that this is the real deal.
Mm.
And I think they get I haven't seen it in years, but they get, you know, caught out at the last minute because I think one of them doesn't know what way the fridge door opens or something like that. Like, they're like, okay, so make us a cup of tea, and they're just not so fluid with the kitchen in the way that you would be if you properly lived there.
Yeah.
And I've often thought about that in regards to detail about things that, you know, and whenever I'm writing, it's detail rich, you know. Actually, Stephanie had to come at my script a little bit with the sledgehammer because I'd gotten in like too into the detail, too into the description of things. But that is something that I always appreciate when I read a book or when I see a play or something like that. Those little touches and flurries really make it relatable and make it maybe exciting.
Mm, yeah. Amazing. Right, we have time for one more.
Okay.
So let's do it. All right, here we go. Number 58. Do you have it?
No, I don't.
No worries. Number
one out of six I got.
Duh. Hey, look. Oh, kind of a nice way to finish. We kind of touched on it, but this is a little bit more specific, speaking of. So in terms of artistic creation, what drives you to do what you do?
Again, I'm going to mention Stephanie. I was sitting in Grass Market at the Edinburgh Fringe last year, and she asked me that question that your relations ask you, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't really know. And she said, well, next time you're performing Humours, so tonight or whatever, tomorrow, I want you to stand on the stage after your warm-up in the empty auditorium, and I want you to imagine being in your next play. And what are you about to say in that moment? And I thought of something, and my eyes just welled up, and she said, I don't want you to tell me what you're thinking right now, but that's your next play. And it's interesting, like, that's the thing that I got funding for from Dun Laoghaire.
Mm.
Now I haven't touched it in ages, which is why I'm not going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you always know what it is. Like, I don't think you need to decide.
Yes.
Necessarily what the next thing is to write. I think it's just, it's there.
It's there.
Like, as long as you just put pen to paper, you want to go, oh God, now what am I going to write about? You know what to write about.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's a very short answer.
Yeah, that's a very good answer. Max McCullough, thanks so much for doing this.
Ah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Of course. Would you do me a favour? Would you tell me about anything that you want to talk about? So I know you're going away with Claps and Horse.
Yes.
Or any other little bits and bobs that have come up. Let us know.
Yeah, as I said, well, if anyone's in Bergen, in Norway.
Huge, huge personality bingo community there.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah.
We got one even, guys. What are we now? Wednesday the 5th. So we're there, we're flying out tomorrow. So we're there performing Friday night and Saturday night in Bergen. It's a play that was on in the Dublin Fringe Festival last year called Requiem for the Truth, in association with the Stomptown Brass Band. I'm filling in for Ruth McGill, who is otherwise occupied for these two performances, but that's actually going on tour, so there's dates for people to check out. I'm sure they're available on the Clapsing Horse website. It's going all over Ireland, and And then it's coming back to Dublin, I think, in November. And other than that, I am a busy little writing monkey at the moment. So a play for Ireland, our first round submission deadline is December. So I'm kind of gearing towards that. So I can't really announce any like particular showings or times for that. I don't know.
That's great.
There's so much theatre. I mean, I'm doing Next Stage this year.
Oh, brilliant.
So I'm really, really looking forward to seeing every show from the Dublin Theatre Festival, bar I think two. And The Fringe is coming up like next week.
Yeah.
This week.
I think there's some stuff starting this week possibly.
Yeah, maybe. So, rather than plug my own stuff, just, you know, see as many Fringe and Dublin Theatre Festival shows as you can and be inspired.
Yeah.
And then follow that inspiration.
Love it. Mags McCullough, thanks for playing Personality Bingo.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
So, guys, that was the epic Mags McAuliffe playing Personality Bingo. Mags, if you are listening, a massive thank you to you for taking the time to do it. It was a pleasure getting to sit down and chat to you and get to know you that little bit better. So, thank you so much. As always, guys, a few quick thank yous to the boss woman, to the brilliant Erin Lindsay for mixing, editing and producing this podcast and for just generally being a ray of sunshine in my Facebook messages from time to time. It's always lovely. To the brilliant Leah Moore and Anthony Manley. I had to think about it because they're just that good, mind-numbingly good. And as always, to Conor Nolan for his beautiful artwork. To Paddy O'Leary and Alan Bennett, thank you so much, lads, for having us part of the network. As always, it's a pleasure. And to you guys for listening. If you do enjoy the podcast, if it is something that you like and you do listen all the way to the end like a rock star, then please do give us a rating, give us a tweet, a Facebook shout out, whatever it is. It really does help to spread the word, and it means the world to me if you do it. But the main thing is, thanks so much for listening. And please tune back in next week for another episode of Personality Bingo with Tom Moore.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.